Welcome to the official UEFA Champions League podcast and our mini-series Classic Matches. And today we're looking at two more iconic finals from the competition's history.
We start by going back 7 years, late drama in Der Klassiker.
Here's Ribery, it might break for Robben, is this it? It is for Arjen Robben!
We hear from Arjen Robben and Jürgen Klopp on Bayern against Dortmund at Wembley in 2013.
Plus, we reflect on a showdown between two of Europe's most successful clubs, Barcelona and Manchester United.
Messi! What a header! And what a goal for Barcelona, which might well seal the Champions League!
We relive the 2009 final on UEFA Champions League Classic Matches. Chris Parrott and myself, Rob Daly, are back again. Chris, I'm really enjoying doing these nostalgic look backs. We don't have to go too far back for these ones, sort of the last 10, 11 years, but great finals 2013 and 2009.
Yeah, they were. I think a brilliant performance from Barcelona in Rome, as we'll get onto, and a fantastic final between Bayern and Dortmund, which was a lot closer really in terms of the actual match, but both were great watches. And also, if you look at the four coaches involved, Rob, some of the best ever.
Yeah.
Sir Alex Ferguson and Jupp Heynckes, the kind of old stages, and then the new kids on the block, really, who have taken coaching onto a new level, because these two matches were the first finals that Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola were involved in the Champions League era.
That's a great point. I hadn't really thought about that. Okay, we're going to be discussing both these finals because they're being shown on UEFA.tv this week. That's UEFA's OTT video platform. Either go to UEFA.tv or you can download the app on the Apple and Play stores. That's what I've done. It's really easy to do. And on Tuesday, the 9th of June at 1700 CET, it's Barcelona against United in full. And at Wednesday, the same time, it's Borussia Dortmund versus Bayern, which is the first game we're going to talk about, Chris, an all-German affair. And personally, you know, I work on German football. It is one of my favourite finals. The colours of red and yellow. I just remember dominating London and we were both working across the final and all the build-up that week. It was just a brilliant time. And we were very fortunate to be covering the match at that time.
Yeah, agreed. I think those London public houses that served beer had a pretty good week as well in terms of their finances. Must have been a good 100,000 German fans coming over. And, you know, it's a great rivalry, Dortmund and Bayern. It's one of the biggest games in German football. But I think it was a mutual respect between the fans and the clubs and the coaches. And it meant for a very relaxed atmosphere and a sort of party atmosphere pre the final, of course. And as you mentioned, I always think when Dortmund come to town, those striking colours, there's something about it. You can't miss them. You know, this sort of almost a luminous yellow kit. And you're right. They were all over London. Trafalgar Square was adorned with Dortmund flags. And the good thing was the actual match didn't disappoint, Rob, because you mentioned it's one of your favourite finals. I think it's one of the closest finals that we've seen, really, in recent memory in the Champions League. It was unbelievably tight and it really could have gone either way.
I also loved like that Dortmund Champions League kit. I mean, this is what I like as well, personally, is when we watch back some of these games, just looking at the great kits. And Dortmund had, I think, a specific kit for that season, that yellow and black stripes, which they don't actually really wear. They don't really wear yellow and black stripes, but it's so striking. And I feel like those kits were almost burned into my brain, like how much I liked them.
I mean, this might give away both of our ages, but their kit in the mid-90s was the one that everybody wanted, you know, the black and then a luminous...
Yeah, the highlighter pen yellow.
The highlighter pen yellow. Like, that was when Müller and people and Sammer were wearing that in the 90s. That was an iconic shirt. And yeah, they had another one for this 2013 final.
And credit to the German fans as well, because they came over in their droves. I mean, we saw them not only dominate the city, but also the Champions League festival site in Stratford was just... For anyone who was down there at that time, you know, 7 years ago now, it was absolutely crazy down there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was mad the way they came over.
Are you bringing it up because you got a new superstar friend, Rob? You're going to tell the story?
Of how I became friends with Jadon Smith. I nearly said Jadon Sancho. But I came friends.
You did.
No, but Will Smith was there. It was very weird. It was weird. He was promoting a film with his son.
I seem to remember that you were comparing some match at the Champions Festival and then Jadon came over and said something, basically said, can you give me that football? I want to take a penalty.
Yeah, I was going to lie and say he said I was his inspiration. He just wanted to take a penalty against Edwin van der Sar. And neither him nor Will Smith could score past van der Sar, so unsurprisingly he had to leave the net empty.
I remember Will Smith's penalty was a penalty taken by someone who doesn't play football too much, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, no, he's a basketball guy, isn't he, the Fresh Prince? Yep. So, but let's get back to the football, Chris, of course. Dortmund's first final since 1997. And it was the first one for Klopp, of course. This was 5 years into his reign at Dortmund, Chris.
Yeah, and he'd already beaten Bayern to two finals. He'd sort of reset the order again of German football, I think. Bayern were not as dominant as they are now, for example. He had finished the league season, though, miles behind Bayern in 2012-13. He'd also lost to them in the German Cup quarter-final. But nonetheless, he was in typically relaxed mood before the match. I always love listening to Jurgen Klopp. He gives so much of his time. And he had a joke with a reporter in the press conference who, fairly cheekily at this stage, I think, asked whether he could answer her question in English, not German.
I would like to answer in German, if it's possible.
Of course.
And what do you, with my answer? What do you want to do with this? Somebody will translate you afterwards. Or what? Okay. What was the question? I don't think it's important who is stronger in which parts of the game, I don't know, because this is a game you can win with the right decision in the right moment. Both teams are very strong. That's the reason why we are here. Sebastian Kehl told it, I think, a few minutes ago when he said the small things can decide the game.
Can't really remember a head coach coming over to England and sort of winning over the media in such a way since Mourinho,
yeah.
Probably when he first arrived at Chelsea and just had everyone in the palm of his hands. But let's get on to the detail of the pre-match then, Chris. And I think that was a very eloquent answer in English from Klopp about the level of jeopardy in a final between two very evenly matched sides. Let's go a little bit into detail into Bayern's status going into this final, because, you know, this is a team that had suffered a lot of heartbreak in the competition.
Yeah, it was 12 months after they had lost at home in Munich, of course, to Chelsea, one of the most amazing Champions League finals, which I still to this day don't know how Chelsea did win it, but they did on penalties. And it was actually their third final in four seasons, because Bayern had also lost in 2010 to Mourinho's Inter. So there was a sense that they surely couldn't lose another one, could they? And almost then, I think the players and Jupp Heynckes were asked in their press conference, would that give you a loser's tag, if you like? And we can hear now from Arjen Robben, who would have a fairly key part to play in this game, as you'll hear in a moment. And he was asked after the match, actually, after he'd been their hero, ultimately, whether the defeat of 12 months ago had spurred him on even more for this Wembley showpiece.
Well, I mean, not really pressure, you know. I tried for myself to put it in positive energy, because if you start a game thinking about this big pressure and you have to do it now because you missed a penalty or I always feel a responsibility when I'm playing football.
So Robin started, of course, Rob, and I think if you look at the Bayern 11, it was an immense side. It almost took me aback at how good it was. 4-2-3-1, and this was the 11 that they could pick even without Holger Badstuber and Toni Kroos, who both missed the game. So Manuel Neuer in goal, a back four of Lahm, Boateng, Dante and Alaba. Then Martinez and Schweinsteiger as the holding midfielders, and then this front four, really, Robin, Müller and Ribery behind Mario Mandzukic. That is not bad, is it?
No, not bad at all. Dortmund's side, of course, had the issue that Mario Götze, who was Bayern-bound, and we will get on to the fact that he was leaving for Bayern, it had already been announced that summer, he had an injury and missed the game. Hummels and Piszczek recovered to feature in time, so Dortmund's team was Weidenfeller in goal, Piszczek, Schmelzer, Subotic and Hummels the back four, Bender, Gundogan in central midfield, Royce, Błaszczykowski, Grosskreutz supporting, then Lewandowski in yellow and black. And of course Lewandowski had something of a breakthrough season really in terms of his notoriety, scoring four goals against Real Madrid in the semi-final first leg, and of course they'd also got past Malaga in one of the great Champions League ties, scoring two times late on in the quarterfinals against Manuel Pellegrini's Malaga at the time. Those were the teams. Here's how the drama unfolded at Wembley Stadium.
Nicola Rizzoli looks around the stadium. He checks that we can get underway. One match to be crowned the pride of Germany. one match to be crowned the kings of Europe. Will it be Bayern München or will it be Borussia Dortmund? We are underway in the 2013 UEFA Champions League final at Wembley Stadium. Robin's in here. He's been forced very wide across the face of goal. And it's in by Mario Mandzukic. It's first blood to Bayern Munich in the 2013 final. It's Mario Mandzukic who's done it. Borussia Dortmund 0, Bayern Munich 1. But this is Marco Reus. He's inside the penalty area. And there's a challenge there from Dante, and it's a penalty. It was such a slack challenge from Dante, who just put his leg out and Reus went down. He couldn't go anywhere else. It's an awful mistake by Dante. It's a stonewall penalty. The responsibility is given to 22-year-old İlkay Gundogan, the man who never gives the ball away, the man who is taking responsibility. Mario Götze has got a smile on his face. Gundogan, the coolest man in the house. There's a massive grin on his face now. So young, so talented. He's leveled the scores at 1-1. İlkay Gundogan slots the penalty away with such aplomb, such cool, such composure. It's Borussia Dortmund 1, Bayern Munich 1. It's game on at Wembley. Here's Ribery. It might break for Robben. Is this it? It is for Arjen Robben. Surely the goal that has won the UEFA Champions League. And the man for whom misery struck 12 months ago is the man for who delirium strikes 12 months on. Arjen Robben is the hero of Bayern. He scored the goal which has surely won the UEFA Champions League. Michel Platini hands over all biggies, the European Champions Clubs Cup, to Bayern Munich. Hello, old friend. It's good to see you again. Bayern Munich are the kings of Europe.
A great day in Bayern's history, their fifth Champions League European Cup title. Let's hear from the match winner on his match winner, Arjen Robben.
Well, when I got the ball, I was free. I anticipated on Frank's move, and the only thought was I hope he lets the ball there in the space or a little bit back, but let leave the ball there because I saw the space. And yeah, the ball was exactly in my path, and I took it well the first touch, and that's why I could get away from the defenders. And my first choice was actually to go past him on the left side, but then he made a move, and then I could put it on the other side, and he was on the wrong leg.
Well, it was a lovely, subtle finish from Robben to decide the Champions League final. Joining us now is German football journalist Stefan Potter. Stefan, you were at the 2013 final, first of all. Thank you very much for joining us. What are your memories of London in that time and really a week when it felt like, to me, the world fell in love with German football for a little bit?
It's funny you're saying that because I had a similar feeling when I was in London. I saw all these fans from the two clubs and but I saw also neutral fans who enjoyed the party, the show, and I share that feeling, actually. And it was a great time I had in London. I was there for 3 days, and I always enjoy London, but I especially enjoyed it that time.
And Stefan, we heard in the commentary there, John Bradley's commentary, he alluded to Mario Götze, who wasn't playing. But can you just go back through the extraordinary story? Because he had already announced that he was leaving Dortmund after this game for Bayern.
Yeah, that was actually really weird. And a lot of people were obviously talking about that because not so much him leaving, but the announcement just before the final, that what stirred a lot of people.
When people watch the game back on UEFA TV, they'll see loads of cutaways to Mario Götze because he was in the stands for the game wearing a black baseball cap, looking pretty nondescript, but the camera crews did manage to find him throughout the course of the game. He was injured for the final. How big a loss was Mario Götze? Because we look at his career now, and it has slightly waned. He's set to leave Borussia Dortmund after his second spell at the end of the current Bundesliga season. Just how important was he then as this wonder kid in that Borussia Dortmund side?
Back at the time, he was a lot more lively. He appeared quicker in his movements and everything than today. It was a big loss for Dortmund for that game, and he really could have made a difference that night.
What are your memories of that Jurgen Klopp team, Stefan? Because they started the final so well. They were probably the better team for the opening 25-30 minutes.
Well, Dortmund, it was a typical club side. They were so full of energy. So they are fun to watch. I mean, there are very different styles in football, and lots of people obviously enjoy watching clubs, teams play. And it was one of the finest nights, at least in the opening stages for a club team. It was really good, yeah.
There were so many excellent saves, actually, from Manuel Neuer in that first half to keep out Dortmund. And then at the other end as well, from Roman Weidenfeller, who had this ability to come charging off his line and deal with situations. And at that time, Roman Weidenfeller obviously was in the latter stage of his career anyway. But how impressive were both goalkeepers on the day, Stefan?
That's funny, because I wanted the game to be a good game. I wanted it to show what those two teams were capable of, because I do have sympathies for both of them. And then early on, there were all those good chances and no goals. And I was like, oh, hopefully this is not going to be a goalless game going into penalties. So that was my impression at the time. It was outstanding saves by the goalkeepers, but I was hoping for goals.
The atmosphere was amazing, Stefan. And it was like that famous yellow wall had been transported from Dortmund to London. What was the sense in Germany about this all-German final taking place at the home of English football? Of course, those two countries have such a great footballing rivalry anyway.
Well, even at the danger of English people not liking to hear it, German people do love Wembley, and they do love playing in Wembley, because there's quite some history. I mean, there's Euro 96, and there's this last match in Wembley with a Hamann free kick, and the match in the 70s for the Euros. So there's quite some fond memories for German football fans of Wembley. And this match taking place in Wembley was really special for Germans. And well, they love Wembley anyways, even when England play and when they don't play Germany. So Wembley is very special for German fans as well.
Okay, well, obviously Bayern went on to win the final. Let's hear from Arjen Robben once again about the strength of that Bayern side.
The biggest reason is that we are a real team, and we fight for each other, we run for each other. Defensively, we were unbelievably strong this season. And then you have players who can make the difference. And well, tonight in the last minute, I scored the goal, but I think it's only credit to the whole team. And I mean, I'm really proud to be part of this team.
What did it mean for Arjen Robben, do you think, Stefan, after the disappointment not only of 2012, but also, you know, Bayern had lost the final in 2010, of which he was a part. How important was that game, that match-winning moment, do you think, for Arjen Robben?
I think you can hardly describe how important it was. There's not only the two lost Champions League finals, and in one of those he squandered a penalty, and then there's the 2010 World Cup final. If you remember, he had this glorious chance to get Netherlands the title. And he looked like an incomplete hero, maybe even to himself, certainly to outsiders. And this goal that changed everything, his whole perception, how his legacy will be seen. So it's a moment that couldn't have been bigger.
I think you can see that when I watched it back and you see him running off celebrating with complete emotion. And then he sort of stops when all his teammates go back to the halfway line, and he has another little moment with the Bayern supporters. And this was the end of an extraordinary season, really, where Bayern won the treble, Stefan, and really completely dominated Dortmund in the Bundesliga. Was it much of a surprise then that the final actually was a lot tighter than maybe some of their league games had been?
Not really. It was a time when Dortmund were really on par with Bayern. Maybe not that year, but in the previous years and in between. It's a bit different to today. Today, there's a gap in performance. And back then, the gap wasn't that huge. So everyone was expecting this to be a tight match in Germany.
And of course, they had this another pre-match narrative around it. It was that Mario Götze was leaving Dortmund, that the Jupp Heynckes was leaving Bayern, because Pep Guardiola had been announced months prior to be his successor as head coach. Was there a feeling of Heynckes being hard done by, given what he ended up achieving? And I'm sure the Bayern hierarchy couldn't have foreseen a treble, that he was hard done by, and of course he did come back, to ultimately lose his job at that time, having just delivered the greatest season in Bayern's history.
There certainly was that kind of feeling, especially in the public. It's not like people didn't want Guardiola to come. They very much wanted him to come. But at the same time, a few weeks after the Guardiola signing was announced by Bayern, it was actually Uli Hoeneß who said that Heynckes probably would have liked to continue his job. And that, in the end, that started a discussion about it in the public. And yeah, Heynckes, they call him a gentleman. And so he really never voiced anger. But he did mention after a while that he actually would have liked to continue.
And of course, one of the ironies is that whilst Guardiola achieved great things at Bayern, he never won the Champions League. So do you recall at the time, did people think, given they had won it and Guardiola was coming, that this was going to be the start of the type of great era that we'd seen in the past for Bayern, maybe winning the European Cup on successive seasons?
Absolutely. That was the expectations for many people. But I don't quite understand that, to be honest. I mean, simple math, in my opinion. You have 6 to 8 clubs seriously committed to winning the Champions League, and certain clubs haven't won it even once, even though they invested a lot of money and brought in huge players, great coaches. So you simply cannot plan on winning the Champions League. You simply cannot guarantee winning the Champions League. And so I wasn't surprised that didn't end in an era.
Yeah, I've always been of the personal opinion that if you're at that level that you're talking about, Stefan, and I think that's really interesting to say that about the numbers of teams and the level of commitment there is to the Champions League, that really all you can really hope for from your head coach is get us to the semi-finals. And then at that stage, luck, tiny margins, everything comes into play. And maybe that's part of the reason that it never quite happened for Guardiola, who did bring Bayern to Champions League finals. Let's quickly flip back to Dortmund now, because obviously it was the end of the Heinkes era for Bayern. And maybe it was the turning point in the Klopp era. I'll get your thoughts on that in a moment, Stefan. But first of all, let's hear from Jurgen Klopp post-match about whether this was the end of that Dortmund side.
We tried to come back to another final. That's what I told them. Now we have to make holiday, buy some players because we need some players, because other clubs want our players. And then we start again and then we'll see. Maybe next year we are in... The target is Lisbon. I know it's not the right thing. But in 2 years, there's Berlin, I heard. Maybe this would be a good place to come back in Champions League final.
Well, of course, they wouldn't win another Bundesliga title under Klopp, having won the German top flight twice under Klopp. And they wouldn't reach the finals in Lisbon or Berlin either. No shame in that, given the resources that were pulled away from the Dortmund playing staff in the end, including Robert Lewandowski to Bayern. But was that season, do you think, Stefan, a turning point in terms of Jurgen Klopp's time and the glory days, his glory days at Borussia Dortmund?
In hindsight, it definitely was. I wasn't sure about it at the time, but in hindsight, you can say he built a young team around players like Hummels, like Götze and the others. And they were rather unknown and they developed really brightly under Klopp. And that's something you cannot repeat every year. I mean, they did bring in a lot of money, but we've seen so many cases in football where clubs were getting the money is one thing, but spending it wisely to stay on the top is so much more difficult to actually reaching the top and getting the money. That's a bit of what happened with Dortmund. They were not quite able to bring in the players to keep that level of football they played before. But you couldn't know for sure at the time. You can tell it now.
Stefan, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you about the 2013 final.
Thanks for having me.
Stefan Potter there, German football journalist. Chris, let's do a quick nod to Jurgen Klopp now, because there was something else you wanted to pick out from the post-match celebrations for Bayern.
Yeah, and I think it just goes to show how difficult it can be to lose, Rob, not just the game, but then have to watch your opposition celebrate. This is him in his press conference when he was interrupted, really. And I think he does very well here. We're going to hear the clip that he doesn't get too annoyed or downbeat. He's just been asked whether Dante should have been sent off when this happens. And as you can hear, the Bayern team celebrating not very far away at all.
I don't know. I don't know if he could... I'm not sure if 11 against 10, if after that we are the winner, I don't know, but well, it is like it is. It's not to change in this moment, and I feel a proudness comes up in me. Sadness goes away.
And I believe him, Chris, when he says that, you know, because in that moment, that could be a bit of a sickener. You know, you can hear the other team in the joys of celebration. But I really do believe that, and it was a sort of rhetoric he repeated really after subsequent final defeats, 2016 Europa League final with Liverpool, 2018 Champions League final with Liverpool, about his pride in the players and their work, despite, you know, the heartbreaking nature of a European final defeat.
Yeah, and despite all of his incredible coaching, there were some people who said... Well, yeah, but he never gets over the line in finals, which I always think is incredibly tough to stick that on somebody, which is why I think Jurgen Klopp himself and lots of people were delighted when, of course, last year he did get Liverpool over the line and he won the Champions League. And I think there, we could probably do a whole podcast, actually, on the difference between Dortmund 2013 and where Klopp is now, that he lost the final with Dortmund, and probably it was the beginning of the end, mostly due to financial reasons, potentially, and Dortmund's whole philosophy, really, as a club. He couldn't take them on to win it, whereas with Liverpool, he lost one final, and it was very much the start of something special, as we've seen now in the Champions League, and of course now in the Premier League, as Liverpool stand on the edge of winning their first title in a couple of generations.
I was reading a compelling case for the shift in power, not that Dortmund's lasted that long, but obviously they did win two titles in 3 years in Germany, that the 2012 Cup final, when Dortmund comprehensively beat Bayern, was the moment where they almost bopped Bayern a bit too hard on the nose.
Yeah.
And Bayern went, right, no more of this. We're going to take your most exciting young talent. We're going to get the best coach in the world. We're going to take Robert Lewandowski. We're going to absolutely dominate. And you can't help but respect that a little bit. That utterly ruthless winning nature, because, you know, they're on the brink of an eighth title in a row now in Germany.
Yeah, agreed. But, you know, that said, when you watch this final back, it could have gone either way. Do you know what I mean? And I think that is the frustration in Dortmund, because, you know, Dortmund are a huge club. The support is massive, as we know. But financially speaking, they are not up there with Bayern or with some of the other real superpowers. So they don't get that many chances in finals, I think, is what I'm trying to say. So when you come so close, it almost hurts that bit more.
Well, it was a sensational Champions League campaign, 2012-13. There were so many brilliant moments. And if you want to check out some throwback content from that season, 2012-13, there's going to be loads of it on social media channels, Champions League social media channels, in the coming days. Loads of great goals, assists, moments. I've seen the list of some of the stuff they're going to be sharing, like Cristiano Ronaldo's famous performance for Real Madrid against Manchester United, Chris. Over the two legs, of course, he eliminated his former employers. It wasn't like he scored a hat-trick in both legs, but that was one of the iconic performances of the Champions League era.
I think so, and the fact that there'd been so much talk about him going back to Old Trafford, and the way in which he didn't really celebrate, and there was great mutual respect, and that continues to this day, actually, because Ronaldo's name is still sung around Old Trafford on occasion. And I just wonder, had he ran off and celebrated and really stuck it to the United fans in the season we're talking about, whether that would have dimmed his legacy there, but certainly not the case. And yeah, definitely check those out on the Champions League's official social media channels, as you say.
Chris, it's almost as if we planned it, because we're going to be talking about Cristiano Ronaldo in a Man United shirt next. Okay, Chris, we're going to go back another 4 years now to our second final this week, which is Barcelona versus Manchester United in Rome.
Yeah, we've already on an earlier podcast discussed their 2011 final at Wembley, which Barcelona won. So this was the first of their doubleheader, if you like, and the only final to this date, Rob, where Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo went head to head. It was Ronaldo's final game for United before that world record move to Real Madrid. And United were looking for history, because 12 months before this match, they had beaten Chelsea in Moscow on penalties. So they were looking to become that first team to retain their crown in the Champions League era in what was the 66th game of another mammoth season. But they bumped into Barcelona and Pep Guardiola, Rob. It was the end of his first season in charge. And this Barcelona team was pretty special, to say the least.
Yeah, I remember some of the build-up around the time. Everyone was calling this basically the dream final. I remember that being a headline in The Guardian in reference to a statement from the then Barca president, Juan Laporta, who said that this was the dream final. And even then, you know, only one season in, some people were saying this was the best Barcelona side that they'd ever seen. We've talked about United and Barcelona a lot on this podcast in recent weeks, given their 2011 meeting. So why don't we let someone else take the lead, someone who actually played in the game. This is Thierry Henry's story of the 2009 final. He's spoken to Heineken about it.
Around 70,000 fans packed into the Stadio Olimpico as the curtain falls on another season of European football. A mouth-watering occasion this promises to be.
We're about to do the treble. I couldn't bend my knee. I just couldn't bend my knee. I couldn't accelerate properly. Same with Iniesta. Iniesta had a problem with his thigh. He couldn't sprint. I couldn't sprint. I couldn't play. But remember, we already had four guys out.
A long way out, but We know he can score from here. Oh, it's difficult for the goalkeeper. And it's been put over by Park. Well, I think there was a fantastic intervention there from Piqué. Ronaldo strikes it. Too hot to handle for Valdez.
In the first 5 minutes, we were not there. And then, as you know, when we used to take the ball away from you, you're going to struggle to get it back.
Great run forward from Iniesta. Brilliant from Eto'o. Oh, it's there! Barcelona's first attack of the final. And Samuel Eto'o has given them the lead.
Having the ball it's important because we were all dead. We were all injured. We were missing players. But when you have the ball, you don't have to run. This is why that plan is amazing. Because if I had to play alone up front and they had to kick the ball, I would never have been able to play. But I knew I would have been able to play in that system because we have the ball most of the time. You don't need to sprint so much.
That was an awkward one for Giggs back defending, but he did well. Champions League.
I won the Champions League. That's the thing that was missing. I was over the moon. You know, I was like, finally. And I think, you know what? That day, something, it was kind of weird. It was like kind of an end for me.
Look at the smile on the face of Carles Puyol. A smile that says, Barcelona, Champions League winners, 2009. What a team. What a performance.
Triumph for Barcelona, a debut season triumph for Pep Guardiola. And what was staggering, Chris, really, when you look back at this pre-match is that the team wasn't in the best shape anyway, and there were key players missing through suspension as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Thierry Henry had knee ligament damage but played through the pain, the same as Iniesta. They were missing their first choice fullbacks. Dani Alves and Eric Abidal were both suspended. Plus, Rafael Márquez, who would have started at centre-back, he was missing as well, Rob. So, Carles Puyol started at right-back, and Yaya Touré dropped into one of the centre-back roles, which, given the level of performance from Barcelona that night, to do it without, well, arguably three of their first-choice back four is pretty amazing.
And as Thierry Henry has said, keeping the ball was so key to Barcelona because they couldn't afford to chase United in possession because the group was so injured. And they did do that really well. But they didn't actually have a, you know, watching the game back this week, Barcelona had a bad start. United were at them in that opening 9 minutes before the Samuel Eto'o goal.
Yeah, the Eto'o goal was really first foray forward for Barcelona. And I think from a United point of view, they look back at it and think, well, had we scored, had Park converted that chance, then they may well have gone on to win the game because they had such firepower themselves. And I think it was such a crushing blow when Eto'o scored. And it was a slightly disappointing goal, I think, to concede, maybe from Edwin van der Sar's point of view. And, you know, Eto'o had skipped past his marker as well. I think that was such a big blow because they'd been the better team. Then to suddenly find themselves 1-0 down against this Barcelona side was a pretty difficult thing to come back from.
It was one of those sort of toe-poke stabs finishes from Eto'o, a real finisher's instinct. And I think, you know, when there isn't that much backlift, I wonder if sometimes, you know, a goalkeeper can be caught out in that scenario. And I think it's probably worth mentioning, you know, United weren't at full pelt either in terms of the personnel available to Sir Alex Ferguson.
No, I think one of the big misses was Darren Fletcher, who was suspended. They had tried to get that overturned, actually. He picked up a yellow card in the semi-final against Arsenal. But,
oh, yeah, I remember that.
He was a major miss, I think. Probably a very underrated defensive midfielder, actually. And I think he would have helped United out a lot in that game. Just to come back to Eto'o quickly, Rob, we should also probably mention that Guardiola had taken over the summer before and he'd made some big changes. Ronaldinho, he'd let go and he'd reshaped the team. And originally, Samuel Eto'o had no part to play. They had a whole summer of when is Eto'o going to leave. Eventually, it didn't go through for whatever reason. So he was then assimilated back into the squad and he became a key part. Of course, he would ultimately move on to other things, but amazing that Eto'o really, had Guardiola got his way, probably wouldn't have even been in the squad that season. He would have been playing his football elsewhere. And here he is in the biggest night of the campaign, pops up with the opening goal.
There were so many interesting elements to that Barcelona team as well. And one would be Gerard Piqué, having just been essentially sold by Manchester United back to Barcelona, seen as, and Piqué's talked about it previously, I think he said there was one game against Bolton where he knew he lost the faith of Sir Alex Ferguson and ended up going back to Barcelona. And he was outstanding on the night with that brilliant, especially early in the game, with that brilliant block, we heard it there, to deny Park scoring from a couple of metres out, which would have put United ahead in early in the game. It's an unbelievable challenge. And in terms of the midfield, obviously the front line at Barcelona changed a little bit down the years, but that midfield three was sort of set in stone really around that time.
Yeah, this was the, I think, the first great moment for the midfield three of Sergio Busquets, Andres Iniesta and Xavi Robb. And one of the things that Guardiola did in his first season was that he centred his team around Barcelona boys and products of that famous La Masia Academy. And one of those was bringing Piqué back from Manchester United. And the other was, you know, Xavi and Iniesta had already, everyone knew their qualities. But Busquets in particular, I think this was the first season really when he suddenly became the mainstay of that Barcelona midfield. And this night they were so good. I mean, Xavi was unreal. And he had missed the 2006 final. He was on the bench, but he wasn't fit. So he didn't play a part, having recovered from an injury. So Xavi's talked about this being his moment, really, in the Champions League, because he hadn't been able to feature 3 years before. Whereas in 2009, I think he got man of the match, which, given how well Lionel Messi played, Rob, will tell you just how good Xavi was that night in Rome.
Yeah, I think he was one of, I think I totted this up, seven starters for Barcelona who were from the club's academy.
Yeah.
And obviously Pep Guardiola had come from Barcelona B, and the likes of Pedro, who came on as a sub, were part of his graduation, really, from that team to the first team when he took over from Frank Rijkaard. So ultimately it was Barcelona's day. A wonderful header from Lionel Messi, that iconic shot of him having lost his boot in the process and carrying the boot and celebrating, one of the iconic Champions League images. And we mentioned it there that it's the first time and the only time that him and Ronaldo have been paired in a final. I wonder if it was really, because, you know, that was all the talk. When you look back at all the old newspaper headlines, which I was doing for this podcast, when you look at all the pre-match build-up, so much of it is Messi, Ronaldo, Messi, Ronaldo. And I wonder if that was real. You mentioned as well Ronaldo moving to Real Madrid, whether it was the kickstarter of what has become, you know, I'd be close to argue, you know, you'd probably go Pelé, Maradona would be one, but in terms of like playing each other on such an extraordinary basis, the greatest head-to-head individual rivalry in footballing history.
Yeah, I would agree, I think. And we all know how both players have spoken a bit about it, how it's spurred them both on, because they have been the two greatest players of their era. So often matches are teed up as an individual against an individual, which isn't really the case because it's very much a team sport. And I think Messi, you could say, outplayed Ronaldo on that night. But I think if you put Ronaldo into that Barcelona team, he would have loved playing in it. He'd probably never want to admit it. And Barcelona fans wouldn't. But, you know, that midfield access were so important. And actually, Henri, he's spoken about how he went to Barcelona and they basically redefined him as a player because he wasn't the main man like he'd been at Arsenal. And basically, Guardiola centred things around Messi. And so if you wanted to play, you had to help Lionel Messi. And Henri did that very, very well. And just that header, Rob, to go back to it. I think it was the night when, what's Messi, 5'7", I think, about 1.7 metres. I think we knew he could do pretty much everything. But when he scored that header, you just thought, well, he is just a complete player. How on earth has he done that, given his stature?
Yeah, he tormented them. As Manchester United centre-back, Rio Ferdinand will gladly testify.
In terms of making you think, he's definitely the... was the most intelligent player I played against. Messi, obviously the two Champions League games we played against him in the finals, he was the main difference really. Top player, and the records that he's breaking now are just phenomenal. Him and Ronaldo are the best two players in the world by a mile.
Extraordinary performance from Lionel Messi and from Barcelona. He made up a front line that is... it's hilarious, actually, really, that these three players were all in attack together, regardless of, you know, what condition they were in going into the final, in Henri's case, a bit injured. But Eto, Henri, Messi, I mean, that's three of the great striker talents of this century all playing together, all yes, in essence, who can play as centre-forwards, all somehow working into a front three. And then from Manchester United's point of view, you had Rooney and Ronaldo, again, talents of their generation, along with Carlos Tevez, along with Dimitar Berbatov. And I put it to you, Chris Parrott, that it is the greatest selection of forwards ever seen in a Champions League final. I've just had this thought in the last five minutes, so you'd probably dismantle it in one second. But I can't think, I mean, ridiculous.
Your point is certainly very strong, and apart from Berbatov, they were, most of them, certainly Rooney, Messi and Ronaldo, were in their early 20s, I think, in 2009. Which, given what they would all go on to achieve, I've had a very quick look whilst I've been talking this, and the only one that springs to mind, I think, is actually a final which ended goalless. You might think wins you the argument straight away, but Juventus against AC Milan in 2003, the four centre forwards.
Go on, yeah, very good.
In terms of pure goal scorers, okay, finishers.
Yeah.
For Juventus, David Trezeguet and Alessandro Del Piero.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Milan, it was Andrei Shevchenko and Pippo Inzaghi.
That's not bad.
Now, those four players are all pretty phenomenal.
That's not bad. I'm standing by mine, but that's pretty good. Some good finishes there.
I'm very pleased my brain suddenly went to 2003 and didn't try and pluck something stupid out of the air.
Well, let's finish very quickly by talking about the contrasting head coaches. For Sir Alex Ferguson, it was his 23rd year at Manchester United, and you know, none of us knew that he'd never win the Champions League again. The 2008 would be his last triumph in the competition, and it was Pep's first season. I mean, that really is. And considering it wasn't just inheriting a team, a bit like, you know, I'd almost point to Liverpool's boot room philosophy of the 80s, whereby the manager would come in, the team would be relatively the same, and the philosophy would continue. Pep did change the way they played. He made the dramatic changes to the starting 11, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Got rid of egos maybe a little bit as well in that dressing room. And what, absolutely remarkable to do that.
Well, yeah, Rob, so... In 2006, under Frank Rijkaard, Barcelona won the competition against Arsenal. So 3 years later was this match, and only three of the starting 11 was the same. Valdez, Puyol and Eto. And I've already mentioned that Eto potentially might not have even been at the club.
Yeah.
And there's a great moment, and if you watch the game on UEFA TV after the match, when Thierry Henry shoves the trophy basically in Guardiola's hand, and he almost says, "This is for you, this is yours." And Guardiola's being quite sheepish, you know, wanting the players to have the adulation. But then he goes over to the Barcelona fans with it. And I think it's a very nice moment, because you thought this guy was a great player. But to win the treble in his first season as a coach with the brand of football they played, I think we all knew that we were seeing something very, very special.
Yeah, and that footage of Guardiola being thrown in the air is another one of the lasting images of the Champions League era. Okay, so Chris, next up, impossible task, dream team from the four teams we've discussed so far today. Okay, Chris, it's time to continue the tradition that we've had in all these classic matches podcasts, where we have to pick a dream team. This is completely pointless, this exercise, by
oh,
the way.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Isn't it? It's just...
It's good,
pick a dream team from the four teams we've discussed. I think it's good as well. So, Barcelona United 2009, and then, of course, Bayern Dortmund 2013. So, let's go goalkeeper and defenders. What's your side looking like?
It's hard this week. I don't know why, it just is. I've gone...
Yeah, it's horrible.
I've gone Victor Valdez in goal.
Yeah.
Puyol right back, which is where he played. By the way, there's a great moment when, just to complete a perfect performance, Puyol bombs up the pitch like a right winger and almost scores to make it 3-0.
oh, yeah, there is, yeah.
Yeah, right at the end. So Puyol, Piqué, Yaya Touré and Philipp Lahm, my back four.
Oh, so you got Yaya Touré, the makeshift centre-back for Barcelona, in there?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not bad. Wait, are you playing Lahm at left back?
Yeah, Lahm's at left back.
What? He played right back in the final. You can't do that.
Well, he's in there. He's in. Look, he's.
Chris, every week.
He's left back, and Paolo Maldini is still at right back. That was my. that was one of my dreams.
Okay, so I've got Neuer in goal because he was unbelievable, especially in that first half.
Yeah,
made some brilliant saves from Marco Reus and Lewandowski. And then I've gone Lahm. PK, especially because of that brilliant block in the first half. Mats Hummels, who was, you know, that might have been amongst his best time as a player for me when he was at the heart of that Dortmund back line. And then I've gone Patrice Evra. None of the left backs really, I mean, David Alaba was emerging as such a good player, but I've just gone for Patrice Evra. He's my only Manchester United player as well. I needed to get one in there. So that's my defence. Midfield, Chris.
I've gone I quite like this. I think they would have played well together, actually. I've gone Schweinsteiger, Xavi and Gundogan.
Oh, I like that.
You're not getting the ball off those three, that's for sure.
No, I think my memory of that 2013 final, and I know Robin got man of the match, is that Javi Martinez was absurdly good. I really remember that really strongly, like even from the time that he was so good at nullifying a lot of what Dortmund were trying to do in central midfield after they'd ridden that early wave of pressure. And you could see why Martinez, prior to his move to Bayern, was wanted by Barcelona, because it made sense what kind of player he was as well. And then I have got two Barcelona midfielders, because Xavi and Iniesta were absolutely outstanding in the 2009 final. And then the front line.
Go on.
This is a problem, isn't it? All right, so I've gone Robin. Not only did he score the winner, superb assist for Mandzukic's goal. Then I've got Lionel Messi for very obvious reason. I don't think you can leave Messi out. And then I did have Franck Ribéry in there, right? Because Ribéry's assist for Robin's winner, almost playing as a centre forward at that point, was brilliant. But he'd also done the really hard work for the Mandzukic goal.
Yeah.
And it was around that time where he was being discussed for the Ballon d'Or, that Franck Ribéry, and I think he said subsequently that he felt that's the year he should have won it. But then I've put Samuel Eto'o in. So I don't know what I'm talking. Actually, no.
You've just argued your point to change it back to Ribéry, I think.
Even though I said the 2009 final had the best selection of strikers and I've only picked one.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going Messi, Robin, Ribéry.
Well, that's sad, because we would have ended this on a mutual agreement had you stuck with Eto'o, because my front three is Robin, Messi and Samuel Eto'o.
Oh, right. Okay, so I went Neuer, Lahm, Piqué, Hummels, Evra, Martinez, Xavi, Iniesta, Messi, Robin, Ribéry.
I've gone Valdez, Puyol, Piqué, Touré and Lahm at left back. Schweinsteiger, Xavi and Gundogan. And then that front three of Eto'o, Robin and Lionel Messi.
Yeah, I think my team would shade it in extra time. I think they'd just shade it.
Well, no, because there'd be a revolt, because Ribéry would be told just before kickoff that you actually wanted Eto'o. And so he wouldn't play for you.
Very good point. Of course, four great teams, two great finals. And over the course of this series, I think we're on the fifth episode now of Classic Matches, we've talked about some of the great finals. It's worth going back and listening to them, because some of the people we've had on the podcast to discuss these games has been brilliant. You can hear about the miracle of Istanbul, Edessa for Real Madrid, and United's infamous comeback in 1999 at Camp Nou. Chris, though, a reminder of how people can watch the two amazing finals we've been discussing today in full on UEFA.tv.
Yeah, just go to UEFA.tv, Rob, or download the app on the Apple and Play stores. Simply log in or register, and it's free to watch. So on Tuesday, it's Barcelona against Manchester United from 5 p.m. CET. And then on Wednesday, it is Dortmund against Bayern at the same time. Remember to get involved as well on social media if you've got anything to say about this podcast, or pick your 11s. It's hashtag UCL Classics, and don't put Philip Lahm at left back, probably. And also, there's some great content going up on the Champions League social media channels as well in the coming days. Goals, assists and great moments from the whole of the 2012-13 season, which culminated, of course, in Bayern lifting the trophy.
And that's it for the mini-series. We hope you've enjoyed them. Chris, we've had fun, haven't we?
Very much so, yeah.
And we'll be back, of course, once the Champions League returns. In the meantime, take care and stay safe. For now, it's goodbye.